I'm very glad to be here. I thank Sylvia and her colleagues at the Hake Bay, which indeed I have been delighted and proud to be associated with for quite a long time now. And I should just observe that Hake Bay was the first institution, I think, that invited me to Berlin. So I owe eternal debt to Hake Bay for opening this city to me and opening itself to me. And since then, I've been graced with the opportunity to come here several times. And now, as someone who's living in Berlin for the present, but I'm hoping the present is an extensive temporal space, I'm even more happy to be here. And this project, Schools of Tomorrow, though I sadly have not been able to come to the previous sessions, I've looked at the program closely and the range of subjects and people. It's remarkable, important, urgent, because I take Schools of Tomorrow to be about the broader question of educating a global public in some ways which are not conventional and not certainly not routine and not always supported. So it's a great pleasure to speak on this occasion. I'm going to try and follow the clock carefully. Sylvia has told me that I should talk for about 30 minutes, which is fine and plenty for what I have to say. The problem with giving a talk like this to a group like this and to an audience like this is how not to bring coals to Newcastle or tell you things you already know well. It's always a challenge. It's further a challenge when whatever little somebody like me has to say has appeared in print, and some of you know some of that printed work. So repetition or reading out of some page proofs from 4 years ago or 6 years ago is not advisable. So what's new, so to speak, or what can you bring to the table in a very rich engagement like this is something I've been pondering for a few weeks now, and even more today. And I'm speaking without notes because I don't want to read from something I already have, but tell you what I'm thinking now, so to speak. So I have two or three points to make, and I'll take 5 or 10 minutes on each and finish in a timely way. My watch has this interesting quality of being fairly unreadable, but I think it's 7:41 or so. So by 10 after 8, I'll be done, maybe earlier, because I also want to hear Carmen and to hear what conversation comes out of this evening, and from your thoughts over the last few days here at this conference. So I'm aware that I'm talking to a group of people who are all thinking about new ways to intervene in education at all levels. Primary, secondary, high school, college, university, very large challenge, and that many of you are involved in active enterprises to do just that, to challenge the current ways in which education is conducted, institutionalized, performed, and to provide credible alternatives which might open up let's say new tomorrows, which we don't envisage today. So I'm going to take as my main focus, though I have two or three small points, but the main focus connecting them is this. It is something I have written about here and there, and it's also in the book, 2013 book, The Future as Cultural Fact, but I think it's worth revisiting because it's not an idea with wide acceptance or even wide understanding. So for those of you who read that particular essay in my 2013 book, forgive me for a little bit of repetition, but I'll try to move that argument in a newer direction or in an additional direction today. So my thoughts are organized around a very simple idea, but a very important idea, which all of us use and refer to and practice in our various ways. And that is the idea of research. Research. I'm not exactly sure, because my German is virtually non-existent, what the exact word for research is. I will also do some research on that. But it's not simply knowledge, it's not simply education, it's not simply curiosity, it's something very particular. And for at least 15 years now, I have been aware that the exclusivity, privilege, and elite kind of quality of higher education, particularly university education, is tied up with this word. In other words, universities, forgive me for these occasional viral episodes, universities think of themselves as being monopolists of the practice of research. So I have been wondering for some years now, what is this idea? Because we have a lot of critiques of knowledge, of epistemology, of education, including great thinkers like Ilyich and so on. But what about research? So it happens that in Berlin, we have the university which is associated with being the first research university in the world, and that's Humboldt, where I happen to be, Humboldt University, where the idea was that the creation of new knowledge through research was a vital part of education at the university level and maybe even beyond. So Berlin has a very special place in the history of this word and this idea. And it might be noted as a footnote that the two places in the United States which took up this German idea of a research university were Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore and the University of Chicago, where I both studied and later became a faculty member. But I never realized that the University of Chicago, along with Hopkins, was the place where the German idea of a research university first began to take life in the United States. Anyway, many years after that, in around the year 2000, I began to wonder, what is this thing, research? What is this practice? And I, without telling you the whole story, I can say that I discovered or came to understand that research is a very peculiar, specific idea about how to create new knowledge. And I realized its peculiarity, which also explains why it doesn't exist in other societies, and frankly, does not exist in the West. until the early 18th century, until Humboldt University. So not in the Renaissance, not among the Greeks, not among the Romans, not in the medieval period. Of course, there were universities, but was there research? I ask you to think about that. When I first began pondering this, I realized, could you say that Aristotle, for example, conducted research? Seems a kind of strange way to talk about somebody like Aristotle. Or even much later, someone like Galileo. Did he do research? I'm not sure. So I began to think, what is this thing that is hard to recognize and hard to define? And I realized that one good definition, which is relatively open and is not already preloaded with various assumptions about the West or about universities, but it is open, is that research is the systematic pursuit of the not yet known. You don't know it, but you can systematically pursue it. Not pursue it by looking in a crystal ball, not pursue it by waiting for God to send you a message, but by some systematic procedure. And it turns out that systematic procedure, as it got defined at Humboldt University and then many places in the world, involved collaboration, a collective peer group, many, many other conditions which are features only of some modern universities. Today we think it's everywhere. But in the 17th or 18th century, it was a special thing that you could have procedures which were shared in which to find out something about the not yet known, namely the future. So since this is schools of tomorrow, we have to think about tomorrow. How do we know about tomorrow? If God is no longer alive, which on the whole I suspect he is not, or he's in some kind of early retirement, we have to think of this ourselves. And how do we do so? So we do it by research. In the US anyway, research became a big part of the university, but now that horse has escaped from the barn. Everybody does research. Army does research, church does research, the state does research, corporations do research. The big question is, what's special about university research? Yeah, we teach, we have classes and all that, we have curricula, we have degrees. That's different. But this important thing, research, everybody's doing. So the problem is, what's special about universities? Serious challenge. And of course, many other institutions issue their own degrees. Again, in the US, this is very clear. The Army gives its own degrees. Microsoft gives its own degrees. The church issues its own degrees. Everybody's a degree game too. So what the hell is a university doing? I'm kind of additional player in this space. So this is part of the crisis of universities. It's not just academic freedom and funding and humanities. It is all these activities, teaching, certification, expertise, and research are being done by 100 other institutions. So what's special about the university? I dearly hope this question does not become a dilemma in Germany or in Europe very soon, but it might. So I say all this just to tell you this peculiar activity called research, which is modern and Western and only about 3 to 4 centuries old, is a very special thing. And if we like it in its general form, we have to think very carefully about how to keep it alive. So that's one side of what I want to say to you, is that research is a very specialized European and modern notion of how to pursue knowledge about the unknown. That is, the not yet known. Not the unknown, the not yet known. Now, I move to a second point about research. And here I shift the frame. away from universities, away from science and elites and specialized knowledge and big research breakthroughs and all that, to the world of poverty, inequality, development. The world, in other words, in which most people are not only not doing research, but are hardly in universities. They're lucky if they get to schools. In a country like India, at least 50% of the population is not going to even school. Primary school is a challenge. Forget high school. Forget college. Forget research universities. Funnel is very narrow. So India, with a population of 1.2 or 1.3 billion, produces a lot of scientists, engineers, even humanists, literature scholars who are doing research and so on. But if you look at the numbers, they're a tiny number out of the population base. So, in places like India or in many parts of Africa, Middle East, Asia, Latin America, and even in the US and Europe, many subaltern populations are excluded from that practice we call research. In other words, they have no tools with which to systematically investigate the not yet known. And one of my big missions in life is how do we build the capacity for research for these large subaltern populations? The conventional answer to that is, well, you get them to go to primary school, and the smart ones will go to secondary school, and the smart ones within that group will go to high school, and the even smart ones within that will go to college and university and get PhDs and be researchers. My idea is that this is too little, too small, and will always be too late for the poor communities all over the world. So my main message is, how do we make research a capacity which is democratically available on a mass basis? And here I depart from the people whose main emphasis is, for example, literacy. People should learn to read and write. I'm not departing from them in the sense that I disagree. Of course, people should learn to read and write. But reading and writing, basic skills in number, in letters, in words, in grammar, is not enough. Poor communities the world over are now dependent on a large network of researchers who come from high-level institutions, universities, consultancies, multilateral organizations, philanthropies. Those are all people from above who come to these places to tell them how to do what they do, how to tackle the problem of housing, how to tackle the problem of slum evictions, how to tackle the problem of AIDS. The list is long. But it is generally assumed that these people in these poor communities worldwide, and I've studied them in Bombay and in a few other places, need this expert knowledge to be brought to them. This is even true in very progressive development circles who use words like empowerment, capacity building, and so on, participation. These are all big words now in the development world. So development world has moved on. It no longer says, we will bring technology, we'll inject it into your country or your neighborhood or your region, and things will improve. They say, no, we want you to participate. Participate in defining the question, participate in telling us your goals, participate in developing the methods, in doing interventions, building wells, doing whatever you need to do. You must participate. That is empowerment. Well, it is empowerment, but in this crucial area, which is the area of research, subaltern communities worldwide are out of the picture. They still have to pick up the phone, 800 number, as we say in the US, 1-800-RESEARCH. Can you tell us what is happening? Which disease should be worrying about, etc. And my point of view is very simple, that development in its best sense, which is that everybody should have the capacity to improve their material lives, their social lives, their cultural lives, is not going to be accomplished even with the idea that they should be participants. We have to make them capable of conducting research on their own. And for that, the answer that a few of them should go to school, become literate, go to high school, go to university, get PhDs, is never going to work. Because it's never going to be enough. If you define research as systematically pursuing the not yet known, it has a special status in today's world because it's a world of catastrophe, emergency, and urgency. When somebody's going to demolish your slum tomorrow with tractors and push you somewhere or kill you or disappear you, that is not a problem that you can say is a long-term research problem. It's urgent. So there are two issues. How do you deal with that urgent problem? And how do you do research so that when that catastrophe occurs, you already have some ideas? So you need to have locally that capacity to investigate the not yet known. The not yet known can take very simple forms. Where are the jobs in Mumbai? Where are the livable areas? Where are the areas where the police won't drive you out immediately? These are all parts of changing patterns of economy, ecology, politics. They're not. So I want to say one more thing, that in the circles which I have belonged to myself, a big move in development thinking, global development thinking, was let's also respect indigenous knowledge, local knowledge, what the people themselves know. I say, great. For a long time, I believed it. I thought that is the approach. Ask people what they know. Don't just tell them what you know. But then I realized what people know already is from a long-term history. But what about the thing that happens tomorrow? Stock market crashes. New flyover is built. New things happen in the budget, in politics. That is today's event. Local knowledge is no more valuable than global knowledge when it comes to emergencies. And we live in a world of emergencies. Planetary, climatic, educational, political, economic, cultural. So for me, there is a direct logic that says that subordinated, subaltern, poor communities worldwide must develop the capacity to do research. So in my book, Future is Cultural Fact, I have a chapter called Research as a Human Right. And I say it is a human right because without it, no other human rights will be delivered. I'll conclude my comments with a short discussion, a presentation, of my own efforts to intervene in this. And that is that I, in around the year 2000, did form a small non-profit organization, NGO, in Bombay called PUKAR, which is an acronym, P-U-K-A-R. And the acronym stood for Partners for Urban Knowledge, Action, and Research. It is now more than 15 years old. It's still surviving, which is a big deal. What its main mission has become is to teach research techniques to young people, because our target is youth here. People between, let's say, 18 and 30, usually. Who may be college students, who may be workers, who may be office employees, maybe this or that, but they're largely from the non-English speaking world. They're not operating in the cosmopolitan English speaking world. And while they continue their jobs, because we don't have the money to give them fellowships like Wissenschaft's Colleague or American Academy in Berlin, you know, say, please come for 10 months and we will support you. We don't have all those funds. But we say, come on certain nights and certain weekends, and then we bring people from the world of activism, universities, etc., to teach them. Teach them what? Teach them basic research techniques. How to do an interview, how to do a survey, how to do a small neighborhood ethnography. And we bring in these fellows, because we do call them fellows, youth fellows. It's a very good program. 200 to 300 a year. And they come in groups and say, our problem is this, that in our neighborhood, young Muslim women are not allowed to dress with contemporary dress. They're told to do this and that. But we want to research, why is that so, what to do. So these groups come with an interest, and then we select among them. And then for a year, they are with us learning how to document, which is a very broad word, meaning get data, do surveys, do interviews, do photography, even films. But our other slogan, and this is where I'm going to close, is documentation as intervention. That is, the minute you ask your father, if you're a poor person in Mumbai, how did you become the owner of this small restaurant? Where did you come from? You're already intervening. If you even go to the apartment building in which you stay and interview 5 people and ask them this and that, you are intervening. You're not just documenting something. This is the rudiments of research. And so we've developed a formula, and there may be other organizations in the world, by the way, and I'm always interested in who they are and where they are. Teaching ordinary people, often poorer people, and young people, without forcing them to enter the university system in a full-time way, how to do research. That is, systematically investigate the not yet known. Find out what is going to happen, what are the trends, what are the forces behind what is happening today, etc. So Pukar is one example, and I am convinced that while there are many, many good things to be done in education, in the schools of tomorrow, at all levels, primary to PhD and beyond, and while there are many ways of intervening in the status quo, and I'm sure your conference has discussed many of them, that one thing should not be forgotten, and that is that we do not give the majority of the world's population the capacity to do research. I think it's a valuable capacity. I do not think it requires expert long-term education. I can be taught relatively quickly so that people can become actually informed citizens who don't just have a complaint or a demand, but who also have an analysis of where things could go and how to find a different path. So I conclude simply with one sentence, saying that I think research is a human right. I think research is, though it sounds very esoteric, something that should be a democratically distributed capacity. And I think without that democratic distribution of that capacity, all our ambitions to bring equality, freedom, and justice to the bulk of the world's populations will prove to be inadequate. Thank you.